Coming up on Tech News Today, tributes to A. Schwartz, Apple and PCs on the decline, and more on the CBS CNET controversy. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, January 14th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why we love our cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, iPad, MacBook, or Android smartphones. Find out what your gadget is worth and get cash to upgrade to the latest iPhone at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Sarah... No, I'm Jason Howell.
That's it. Me. That's all you got.
That's all we got.
The other two are sick. And I'm in Petaluma. And it's time for the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Not long after MIT began an investigation into its role in events leading up to the suicide of open access activist Aaron Swartz, Anonymous defaced the school's website. Swartz was arrested in July 2011 and accused of stealing 4 million documents from MIT and JSTOR, an archive of scientific journals and academic papers. He faced $4 million in fines and more than 50 years in prison if convicted. You may or may not be done with enabling Java on your machines, but Oracle still has a fix for you. Oracle released Java 7 Update 11 Sunday, fixing two attention-getting security issues and changing the default Java security level to high. You can get it from the Java control panel or from Oracle's website. However, H.D. Moore, chief security officer of Rapid 7, said it could take 2 years for Oracle to fix all the security flaws in the version of Java used to surf the web. Over to you, Tom. Thanks, Tom. The Wall Street Journal reports Apple cut its orders for iPhone 5 screens last month by roughly half as well, reducing orders for other screens. Analysts have been predicting Apple would face declining phone and tablet sales. The stock market seems to believe the reports, and Apple's stock dropped towards $500 a share Monday. Apple stock has declined 17% in the last 3 months. Well, that's quite a bit, Tom. I know it is. Samsung announced the company has sold more than 100 million Galaxy S devices, including 40 million Galaxy S3s over the past 2 months. That 40 million in 2 months equals the lifetime sales of Galaxy S2s. Monday's numbers from Gartner showed declining PC shipments worldwide by 5% in Q4, but Gartner's numbers show U.S. Mac shipments rising 5.4% in Q4, seeming to contradict IDC's sales estimates from last week, which showed a decline in U.S. Mac sales of 0.2%. The difference between shipped and sold could account for some of the discrepancy. However, most of Gartner and IDC's numbers from other vendors seem to match up much more closely. Yeah, it's really weird. Bexar County, Texas, home of San Antonio, has unveiled its plan of a 100% digital public library. The project is headed by Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf, who says, if you want to get an idea what it looks like, go into an Apple store. Judge Nelson says he was inspired by reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. Artist conceptions of the library show rows of long tables with plenty of computers available. And if the project is successful, it will become the first 100% digital public library in the United States. I wonder if Apple will sue them for that. Baidu and Orange announced a partnership today. Orange will preload its phones sold in Africa and the Middle East with a custom Baidu mobile browser. They will not be iPhones. It's an exclusive deal for 1 year, and the browser will be localized for each market. The first phones with the browser pre-installed will launch later this year, but the browser will be available as a free download starting today. Wall Street Journal reports Apple cut its orders for iPhone 5 screens last month by roughly half as well, reducing orders for other... Oh, wait a minute. I already read that one. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police are looking into the disappearance of a hard drive containing personal information of 583,000 student loan borrowers. The Department of Human Resources and Skill Development first noticed the drive was missing on November 5th, but didn't know the contents of the drive until December. The unencrypted hard drive contained sensitive information like social security numbers and student loan balances. I'm sorry, social insurance numbers. We're talking about Canada with their government health care. And the continuing march of good news for RIM, The Verge reports the company received 15,000 app submissions in 2 days. RIM hosted a port-a-thon January 11th and 12th to encourage developers to submit apps and offered $100 for every app accepted. Also, the first developers submitting multiple apps could get free hardware like a Playbook or a BlackBerry 10 Dev Alpha device. So this wasn't your normal 37.5 hours, but it did provide a lot of apps. And finally, a major cyber attack may have been stealing confidential documents since 2007, according to Kaspersky Labs. Kaspersky told the BBC the malware targeted government institutions such as embassies, nuclear research centers, and oil and gas institutes, and it was designed to steal encrypted files and even to recover files that had been deleted. Well, this episode of Tech News Today may be low on co-hosts, at least for now, regular co-hosts, but it is brought to you by RingCentral all the same. We do everything in the cloud, so when people call in sick, it's nice for them to be able to find me on my RingCentral desk phone, and I can get their voicemail in my email and say, all right, stay at home, get better. I don't want sick people coming in here. Everybody's got a flu enough. You can also use it for faxing. If people are like, want to send you a fax, you're like, fax? Do you still use a fax? Well, RingCentral lets you use the fax. You don't have to use a fax, but they can use a fax. And it keeps you from putting big, expensive PBX systems in your basement. Our IT guy, Russell, said, get a cloud-based phone system, and we totally did, and we don't regret it one little bit. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. They have a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number for our listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com. and use the promo code TWIT. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Now, before the flu struck deep into the heart of Tech News Today, we were happy to have Father Robert Ballesterre on board as our guest today. You're going to have to carry a little extra load now,
That's all good. You know, it's been a while since I've been in the studio for Tech News Today. I have to say, you from Los Angeles, it looks awesome. It looks like you're just here.
Thank you. It's been a while since I've been in the studio from Pedal.
and Ayaz and Sarah look very different today.
Playing the parts of Ayaz and Sarah, we have brought in some amazing pinch hitters, starting with John Strickland from the Tech Stuff Podcast and HowStuffWorks.com. John, thank you for filling in today. We appreciate the last-minute effort.
Thank you, Tom. And I just want to put this out there. I am capable of reading things out loud if you ever need someone to just help break up the list.
Oh, wait a minute. You mean I didn't have to read all 10 of the news fuses alone?
I was feeling for you right around number 7.
Yeah, and then somebody cut and pasted one of the earlier stories over one of the later ones right in the middle of the show.
It was a really good story.
I'm not going to say who. But also, answering the clarion call, we thought, well, we'll ask John and we'll ask somebody else just in case one of them can't do it. But both of them could do it. Brian Brushwood from Framerate joins us today.
See, this works out great because you got Jonathan, because he's so knowledgeable about tech. He can come in last minute and speak knowledgeably about anything. And then me, I don't have to know nothing because my brain disconnects from my mouth every time I'm on a camera. So I'll just talk not having any idea what the stories are.
Perfect balance, right? That's what we're looking at. No, you guys, thank you so much for joining us today. We do have to start off with some very sad news. As we mentioned at the top of the news fuse, Aaron Swartz killed himself Friday. He was the creator of RSS 1.0, Reddit, Creative Commons. He helped create all of those things. He was arrested and was being prosecuted for writing a Python script that he allegedly used to offload large quantity of JSTOR documents from an unlocked network closet at MIT in January of 2011. The JSTOR stores academic documents, and you subscribe to the database and you can download them. He did subscribe to the database. He had legal access to that database. JSTOR dropped the case. MIT waffled on it, and the government decided to champion it. That meant that Swartz was facing more than 50 years in prison and millions of dollars in fines for stealing what they said was millions of dollars worth of intellectual property. Swartz's family said in a statement over the weekend, quote, decisions made by officials in the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney's Office and at MIT contributed to his death. MIT President Raphael Reif has now appointed Professor Hal Abelson to lead a thorough analysis of the MIT involvement in the prosecution and just the general treatment of Schwartz in relation to this episode, the lawsuit, of course. But most people are just very sad. Lawrence Lessig, who is a good friend of Schwartz, posted on a very measured response to this. It's easy to want to point fingers. It's easy to want to have blame. But Lessig wrote, you should go read it for yourself. He doesn't say, though, what Schwartz did was all right. And he doesn't say that the prosecution is what caused him to kill himself. But what he does say in this one quote is, "I get wrong, but I also get proportionality. And if you don't get both, you don't deserve to have the power of the United States government behind you." Several tributes have been taking place on the internet. Academics are posting research papers on Twitter with the hashtag PDF tribute. This was suggested by Micah Allen, along with a few other people having the same idea at the same time. The hashtag was coined by Eva Vivalt, and the wave of tweets was encouraged along by Jessica Richmond. Also, Brewster Kahle, Carl Malamud, and others at archive.org are putting together a Aaron Schwartz Friends repository. For anybody who has electronic files related to Aaron Schwartz, they can post them to archive.org, and there'll be a collection created there. So, you know, I don't want to dwell too much on this. It's sad enough, and we've had all weekend, those of us who were interested in the story, or I did not know Aaron Schwartz, but I certainly was a user of many of the things he invented and a beneficiary of his activism regarding SOPA and PIPA. Father Robert, I just want to go around the table. Any thoughts?
This is a really sad confluence of everything from, you know, a genius young man who had a lot of imagination, had a clear view of, a Lessig-type world where information is free, of mental illness, and of overzealous prosecutors. Now, it's really tempting to point a finger and say, the DOJ just wanted a scapegoat, or that the lobbyists wanted to push forward a bad copyright law, or that, why didn't anyone see the signs coming, when this man needed help? But ultimately, what this is this is a dirty little secret within the tech sector, that some of the most brilliant people we have, some of the brightest luminaries, are also kind of isolated within their own genius. And you know, the people who actually knew Schwartz have said things to that effect, that, you know, they don't want to speak ill of the dead, but they're looking at this man and saying, his passion, his life was his work. He invested himself entirely in that. So when the prosecution really started to push him on that, and when he looked at potentially 50 years in jail, it must have seemed like the end of the world.
Brian, what about you?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's so difficult because this is a tragedy, no matter how you slice it. And it's very difficult to want to politicize something like this in the middle of the fact. And it makes me uncomfortable. But you know, Lawrence Lessig, as in his post, he starts off by saying people are going to say it's too soon. And I'm going to say I don't care, because he obviously felt very intently that the prosecution played a very large role in the fact that he committed suicide, and that it was a disproportionate attack on him given the crime. And again, you know, he makes sure to use the word allegedly, because never got to trial, never got to settle any of it. But certainly, I don't want to grandstand on top of something so sad and miserable as this, outside of to say that if any good can come out of something so terrible, it's that we take a moment and really look at how cases like this are handled. It's just, I don't know, it just bums me out. And I'm with you. I don't want to dwell too much on this.
John, what about you?
I agree with everything that's been said so far. I really think, to me, it seems like you had a man who had a very idealistic view of what the world should be like, this idea that information is free, it wants to be free, and people should have free access to it, especially when you're talking about information that could potentially benefit mankind. And to silo that off seems like it's not right. It's hard to make a case for that. And then when you bring in things like the idea that this information is worth money, and you're bringing a monetization factor into it, then that also seems to actually bring in more ethical problems. You're talking about something that could potentially benefit people, but only if they can pay for it. That seems to be sort of the message that you can come away with in this. And it's a far more complicated issue than that. I mean, if you start to really look at it, you realize that this is a much more complex issue. But from a very high standpoint, if you're doing some just armchair review of this, that's you can walk away with that. And I would think that if I had this view of the world and I really felt passionately about it and I threw myself wholeheartedly into trying to make that world become a reality, and with my goal eventually being that this is something that could benefit people generations from now, and then to see such opposition and persecution for something that I think intrinsically is right, I think despair would be a very natural reaction to that. And it is a truly tragic event that we have seen, and I am deeply saddened by it. I have also benefited directly from Swartz's work, and I was very interested to follow what he might do in the future. And so this has been a very tough story to follow. I hope that good comes out of it, and my heart goes out to his family.
As far as intellectual property goes, now more than ever, we need to examine the benefit that our laws provide as opposed to just the need for them. Do we have laws that actually benefit society? And this doesn't change it. It just puts it in stark reality. As far as Aaron Swartz goes, rest in peace. Apple, of course, is our next story. Wall Street Journal reports iPhone 5 screen orders cut for Q1 2013. Other screen orders cut as well. In December, UBS analyst Stephen Milunovich slashed his iPhone sales estimates for the March, June, and September 2013 quarters by 5 million units each quarter, while sales estimates for the iPad were cut by 2 million per quarter. Also trimmed his earnings estimates. Apple's got an earnings report coming out January 23rd. Is this just the phone market and the tablet market maturing, or does Apple need to do more innovation in its existing lines, or come out with some new product that they can dominate in?
I'll tell you what. Sorry to step right on you. There's on top of this, there was an article that came out over the weekend suggesting that among teens, Apple is no longer perceived as the hip exclusive phone, but instead it's sort of becoming the standard. And the fact that outside of some very minor, at first glance, there's virtually no changes for like 6 years straight looking at an iPhone. And it could be that maybe it's just a little bit kind of fatigued at this point.
I want to push it even further. I think there is a fundamental weakness in the approach, which was originally a strength. And that is Apple has always had this philosophy of the users don't know what they want. We know what they want. We know what we should provide them. We're going to give them the best possible experience. That works absolutely great as long as you don't really have competition. The problem is Apple has competition now, and not just in a general generic sense, but real honest-to-goodness hardware and software experiences that can compete with the i experience. And when that happens, then you're basically repeating what happened in 1980, where you had a superior platform, superior hardware that eventually lost out to choice. Now, Apple is going to keep doing their one model of iPhone, their one model of everything. And this is the price, and this is what you'll pay, and this is what you'll do. And so we sort of get to see that happen again. And we'll see if the environment has changed. Maybe it will work, but I don't think so. I think unless Apple is willing to actually acknowledge that it's no longer top king of the hill, we're going to continue to see the slide. We're going to continue to see their share diminish. We're going to continue to see people hark on their lack of innovation.
This is a Wall Street Journal report. This is analyst estimates. These aren't actual numbers from Apple. John, do you buy them?
You know, I can see this as being an indication of what reality is. It's always tricky because you have to at some point just accept what you are, the information that's coming to you. I also think that there have been very many good points made. I mean, Apple does need to innovate. Perhaps Apple needs to come out with a brand new product. I wouldn't mind either of those things. But it is very true that the competition has become pretty fierce in both the tablet and smartphone arenas. We have more choice than we've ever had before. We've got more choices that actually are compelling than ever before. And, you know, it's it also doesn't help that we've got Apple releasing a new iPhone every year, and we still, in the United States at least, have that contract issue there where you might be missing half of your customer base each time you release a product because they're not willing to break a contract. Now, I know that not everyone is under contract, but that's fairly standard. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that they have to battle here. I would love to see some real extreme innovation in the area of the smartphone to really set it apart again from everybody else. That being said, you know, I've been using Android phones for years, and I love using those. And frankly, for me, innovation in Apple space means that I can look forward to innovation in the Android space in order to continue to compete with Apple. So I want to see Apple innovate and really push the envelope and become, really struggle to be that top dog so that I end up benefiting down the line because I'm a selfish person.
The more I think about it, the more I think Father Robert just nailed it right on the head. I think Apple's strategy works extraordinarily well when they're the innovators and they're first to market. But I think the massively parallel development that you see on the Android side of things, once that engine gets going, develops much faster. Now, the difference is look at Blade Runner future versus other pre-planned society futures. Apple has that everything's elegant. Everything was all designed with the end in mind. Whereas, Blade Runner is this sort of mishmash of everyone trying their own thing to get ahead. I feel like Android is that ugly Blade Runner space where anyone could try anything. And as a result, you get a lot of crappy apps. You get a lot of terrible phones. You get a lot of bloatware, but you also get a lot of rapid advancement because you have this cutthroat, all these different teams advancing, trying to advance their own stuff and eventually pushing the platform forward. I think you're totally right, Father Robert.
So Apple's like Roy, time to die.
Yes, exactly.
On the other side of the hardware market, we have PCs just not being able to pick up sales. The holiday quarter, Windows 8, those were all supposed to help PC sales. Gartner follows on IDC's numbers, showing a 4.9% drop in worldwide PC sales for Q4. Mikako Kitagawa, principal analyst at Gartner, says consumers are shifting their consumption of information to tablets. Cheap tablets beat out cheap notebooks in the holiday shopping season. Lightweight, cheap PCs took the hit. But PC's average selling prices may rise because of this, because what desktops are still good for, the tablets can't do, or the heavy duty stuff, and those desktops are more expensive. They also said in the Gartner report the launch of Windows 8 had no impact on PC demand, especially as ultra mobile products were both limited in supply as well as being priced too high. That's referring to Windows RT, I think. HP took back the top spot from Lenovo in Q4 over the year. Asus had the highest rate of growth, with shipments increasing 17.1%. And in the U.S., Apple, Lenovo, and HP also saw growth in PC sales. So the news isn't all bad, but is this just what we should expect now that we know that everyone's using tablets and phones? Father Robert, you're nodding your head yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you got to remember, it's really easy to massage these numbers and to look at it and say, oh, that means that the PC industry is doomed. You're talking about a drop in an industry that still has huge numbers. You're talking about almost 400 million units a year get shipped for PCs. So when you're talking about a decrease in growth, you're not talking about, oh, people are throwing away your PCs. You mean you're talking about not as many people buying PCs each and every single year, but it's still an incredibly profitable industry. You're not going to see any of the majors pull out of it for another decade. So yeah, we're going to see a gradual transition, and there's going to be a lot of doom and gloom, but it's not going to get rid of my notebook anytime.
Yeah, I find myself using my devices in a lot of different ways, but it doesn't mean that I don't have uses for all of them. John, what do you think of this?
So I think part of it is that we're now getting to a point, actually we've been in a point, where people are figuring out where tablets fit in their lives. And for some people, that fills every need they have of a computer device. It's something that, you know, they're using their computer to mainly consume content. Tablets are great for that. So we're seeing a natural move to tablets in that sense, where people are saying, well, for what I use a computer for, I can get it for, you know, less expensive tablet that's more portable, I don't see why I wouldn't do that. So I think the cost and the use case are in favor of tablets now that we've gotten to a point where people kind of have their minds wrapped around this. I mean, originally we had the people who were just amazed by the iPad, and they thought that this was a great new type of technology. And then as the tablet market began to mature and we saw other competition there, other people began to say, oh, well, you know, the iPad wasn't really for me, but this thing really does work well. So there's that. I think that it's also easier to upgrade tablets than it is PCs. They tend to cost less money. And then what you do is you might buy a PC, but you don't feel the need to buy another one maybe quite as quickly. Maybe you do, you know, you keep that one PC to do some heavy lifting for whatever, you know, applications you need to run, but you don't feel the need to necessarily upgrade it as frequently as you would if tablets and smartphones weren't a thing. So I think all of that is playing a part now. And I agree. I don't think the PC market's going to go away. I think we are going to see a gradual decline in sales just as people buy a machine and then they're happy with that machine for a little longer than they normally would be. Keeping in mind that, you know, people like us, we tend to go through technology a little bit faster than, say, the average consumer.
Brian, how do you use stuff?
Dude, I'll tell you what. This is going to sound like crazy talk, but my favorite thing out of everything you said setting this up was that it's going to cause PC prices to rise. We've talked about this on Frame Rate in the context of watching video streaming. We say that, or I say, convenience trumps fidelity, and the convenience of the notebooks or tablets and smartphones is so high that you don't mind the kludgy interface to modify documents, to send off emails, to do those little things. And of course, there's a massive shift over to there. I personally, this race to the bottom on price for PCs, I think has been terrible for my experience from a PC and what I expect a PC to do. Hopefully what'll happen is that desktops and notebooks will become more specialized. And now that once the price goes up, you can see increased horsepower. And pretty soon your desktop becomes the place where you do stuff like edit photos in Photoshop. Nobody's doing that on a tablet. Edit your videos for posting and doing rendering, 3D modeling, animation, live streaming like I do from my studio right here. These are things that desktops and even some notebooks are exquisitely good at doing because they require, as Jonathan put, heavy lifting power. They require a lot of horsepower. And the faster we can quit this ridiculous race to the bottom on price and instead make the desktop a specific use, heavy lifting computing object, the better off we're all going to be as consumers.
There's another element here, and that is something like this. You know, this is a laptop, but it acts like a tablet. You know, it's got a touchscreen, and we're seeing more and more of these now in the Windows 8 sector, probably pretty soon in the Apple sector. So when we have this combination of technologies, well, what are you going to call this? Do you call it a tablet if it doesn't have a keyboard, or do you call it a laptop just because it does? Or is it just now, do we just start looking at computers? Do we just start looking at client devices? Do we have to define it depending on how much power it has, how much memory it has? You know, that's an artificial distinction. I know you've touched on this before, Tom. When you look at the sales numbers, what you really should be looking is, well, how many people are connected?
Yeah.
How many people have access to the internet? How many people have access to devices that can deliver content to them? And that number is always going up.
I call that another damn thing I have to get some money to spend on, because that's awesome. And that leads us into our other sponsor for today's show, actually, Gazelle. You want a new laptop with a touchscreen? You got to get some money. Sell your old stuff. Go to gazelle.com. It's gazelle.com. All you do is tell Gazelle the condition of the device you're wanting to get rid of. They'll even buy broken iPhones for cash, they say. And I've seen it happen. Get a risk-free offer for your gadgets. Gazelle locks in the quote for 30 days, so you have time to go get the new gadget, actually, while you're waiting. If you're switching phones, that can be convenient. Once you get your new iPhone, ship your old one to Gazelle. They'll even pay the shipping, and then you'll get paid fast by check or PayPal. So go to gazelle.com, get an offer for your old iPhone or your old Android phone or your old MacBook, and do it today, because your stuff isn't gaining value. It's probably losing value every day you wait. Get paid in cash. The risk-free offer gives you time to get your new gadgets. Free shipping. Most items qualify for a free box. Fast processing. No listing hassles. They're paying good money for gadgets right now. So go check it out. See if you can get some good money for your gadget. What's your iPhone worth? Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out. Sell your used iPhone today at gazelle.com. We thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. All right, real quickly, tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., Facebook is having an announcement at their headquarters. They've called in all the press. The rumors are going crazy. Is it going to be mobile? Is it going to be an operating system? Is it going to be a phone? Round the horn. Father Robert, best guess.
See, I want to have a draft on this, stuff like this. I have to believe it's something mobile. It's either a phone partnership, or some sort of phone service that Facebook is rolling out to turn the tide on the revenue.
What about you, Brian?
Dude, they're going to announce that finally, after all the protests, that one post got enough likes that they're going back to the old Facebook from 4 years ago.
John, do you think old Facebook?
No. I've got two predictions. One, they're going to announce radical changes to the privacy terms of service and not tell you what they are. And then the second one is that the timeline will be completely revamped so that it now shows you your posts in order of the color of shirt you were wearing on that particular day, going Roy G. Biv.
We had a little discussion amongst the hosts of Tech News Today when they were well enough to talk, and we decided that we will not do a special coverage, not a live breaking announcement, because Facebook announcements have broken our hearts in the past by just not quite being what maybe we would have wanted them to be. So we're guessing it's going to be new apps, maybe Messenger app for the iPad or something like that. But I'm hoping to be surprised. And during Tech News Today tomorrow, we will cover it during the actual regular show. And who knows, maybe we'll see an operating system. But
well, I'm just guessing. To be a little more serious than my actual prediction there. Ultimately, it's interesting to me that Facebook even bothers to have these things, because you're talking about a service with over 1 billion users, or at least 1 billion accounts. That's not necessarily users. But to me, the thing that Facebook really has to focus on is finding a way of reversing this problem that is bigger than Facebook, which is all about web advertising. And that's the issue that Facebook has to look at. I don't know that Facebook necessarily needs to win over new people. It's nice that they're constantly updating features. I mean, that's a good thing, but I'm not sure there's anything they could announce that would get them a benefit, like with a bunch of new folks. I don't know that would help them. I think really what Facebook has to worry about is announcing something that ticks people off and turns them away from Facebook.
Oh, you can count on that. Doesn't matter what they announce. Yeah,
that's the thing, is that it's a no-win situation, right? I can't imagine them saying anything so amazing that they win people over, but I can easily imagine them saying something that makes people get upset.
So tune into Tech News Today tomorrow for Facebook's solution to the Kobayashi Maru.
$10 a poke.
I want to talk a little bit about this opinion piece that ran on Wired today. Matt Blaze, who directs the Distributed Systems Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, and Susan Landau, who's a Guggenheim scholar and former Sun distinguished engineer, have an opinion piece about the fact that the FBI is expected to push once again very hard this year for legislation that would require a backdoor into the internet. Every switch, every router, every application, every device. Back in 1994, Kalea was passed, which required all telephone switches to include FBI-approved wiretapping capabilities. And Blaze and Landau describe some of the perils that has caused, like the Greek government being hacked and all of their conversations listened in on. They argue that backdoors open way for more crimes while helping to fight other crimes. So it doesn't really help the FBI in the end. And that software is already buggy. They say the FBI should just hack existing vulnerabilities with a warrant. Should the FBI step up hacking in place of legislating mods?
Yes.
You know what? Well, I'll tell you what this makes me think of, and this is going to be weird and counterintuitive. A solution like a legal framework that says give us a backdoor to everything seems like it'll be the obvious solution now to make everything easy for them. But weirdly, this is one of the cases where technology is not the solution if you want something that scales for the long term. If your policy is rely on this one thing that we did way back in 2013, that ain't going to work so hot in 2023. However, if your policy is we need lots of hackers to continuously fight this war and get into these places, that will scale, and all you got to do is hire more bodies or better talent or get farther ahead. So it's weird. This is one of those things where it's like there's always that golden key that's just right. If you just get this one decision, you could do this one thing, and as long as the world doesn't change, it'll work forever. But of course, the world will change.
Bodies are expensive. Legislating a backdoor makes it cheaper.
I want to push up the paranoia here, because something that enterprise people have known for a while is there is a backdoor. There's always been a backdoor. Enterprise class hardware can do what's called a mirrored port or span port or a tap, so that you can send all the traffic from that switch to anywhere. That's built. That's part of the spec. You buy that when you buy the switch. It's very easy to turn that on. I think a lot of this article is a recognition that even if the feds got their backdoor and they got their fingers on the pulse of the internet and they got all the data they wanted, there's just far too much data for them to comb through, even with filters and even with semi-artificially intelligent heuristic programs. So what they're looking at is you're going to need people who actually know what they're looking for. You're going to need people who actually know how to do the social engineering and the hardware software hacking in order to find the gems, the important pieces. You're never going to get that with a backdoor. You have to have human intelligence.
John, right. You agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. Here's my issue. We've covered a lot of the points that I think are important, but there's one that we definitely need to talk about. So, yes, we need people to be able to look at this information. So let's assume for a moment, you know, we're living in an idealistic world and the FBI is going to use this sort of capability should they get it, only for good. There's never going to be any misuse of it. There's not going to be any problems. We're in this idealistic area. Okay, that's fine. Let's assume that they're able to find the information that, as we were just saying, that this massive amount of information there that you're able to weed things out. Let's assume that. All right. You don't make the internet a better place by introducing vulnerabilities. When you introduce vulnerabilities purposefully into the internet, people will find them and take advantage of them, and you have just made the world a much less safe place. And you might be doing it so that you can monitor things and so that you can make sure no one's up to any hanky-panky, but you have in fact enabled an entire world to do horrible, horrible things because they know that these backdoors will exist, and they will just find a way to exploit it. There is no security that is absolutely perfect, and if you even make it known that we've just made it less perfect by introducing a vulnerability, it's game over.
That's well said, John. I think that kind of summarizes my own opinion on it as well. So let's finish off with a happier story. CBS forcing CNET to recast their vote after the Hopper. Now you're like, wait a minute, you guys talked about that last week. Why are you bringing this up again? Well, two reasons why. Joshua Topolsky from The Verge, editor-in-chief of The Verge, had a longer write-up today saying not only was the Dish Hopper going to receive the Best Of nomination. We speculated on that, but he says he's got sources saying, yes, the Dish Hopper was going to receive Best Of, but that is when CBS stepped in and said, no, if you're going to give that the Best Of, then we're you need to kick it out of the competition because that's going to hurt our court case. It's going to make us look bad. And the description of how this went down shows what I suspected, which is the decision came directly from Les Moonves, who's the CEO of CBS. Mark Larkin, who I worked with at CNET and who is the general manager of CNET right now, fought very hard against it. Jim Lanzone, the president of CBSI, who was not there when I was at CNET, fought against it. Lindsay Turrentine fought hard against it. And that the editors and the chiefs of CNET were pretty distraught over the fact that they were strong-armed into doing this. They fought for full disclosure once they lost the battle against kicking out the Hopper. And CBS said, no, you can't disclose all of the stuff that happened behind this. So the second thing that brings us back in the news today is Greg Sandoval, who covers digital media for CNET. We rely on him on Framerate for a lot of our discussion topics, posted on Twitter that he has resigned over this controversy. He says he loves the people at CNET. He supports the people at CNET. He doesn't blame the editorial team there, that CNET wasn't honest about what occurred regarding Dish, and that's unacceptable to him because they are supposed to be truth tellers. So he is leaving CNET. Now, that is not a surprise to me that someone has left CNET. I'm very sad to see Greg go. Hopefully paid content or somebody can snap him up quick.
He won't have more time.
He will. Yeah, he is really good.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see if we will see more of this. I don't know anything. I haven't talked to any of my friends about this who work at CNET still. But what do you think CNET should do? And what do you think CBS should do? Brian, let's start with you.
Dude, this is a major, massive black eye, both on CBS and on CNET. And I feel bad because CNET's really collateral damage in this. And unfortunately, most of the ways to handle this, in my mind, I don't see CNET having the power to do. I feel like now that CBS has involved themselves directly, there's very little that CNET can choose to do to distance itself from this situation or to blame their overlords or any of the things that pop to mind. It just seems like now that can of worms is open and we've seen direct intervention. We've seen this is quite literally the worst nightmare. When CBS bought CNET, this was the perfect representation of what everyone was afraid was going to happen, is that the journalistic integrity of CNET was going to be compromised. And I don't see any other way to spin it on this case.
You know, the scary thing is, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This seems to be the fulfillment of the fears that we had when you started having the last mile access providers being bought by the content providers. You can't put those two together because you have an automatic conflict of interest. And this is that conflict of interest.
I have to say, and the only thing I experienced when I worked at CNET that was similar to this was when Gerstmann was fired. Jeff Gerstmann was fired. Yeah. And we were going to cover it on Buzz Out Loud, and we were told not to. Now, this was not CBS. This was CNET Networks. And CNET Networks PR said, you will not discuss it. And so what we did is we went on Buzz Out Loud, and we said, we know this story exists, and we have been told not to discuss it. We did discuss it later at the beginning of the next week once CNET had decided that it was okay and they had made their response, et cetera, et cetera. But I know how this stuff goes and I know how angry people get about this sort of thing. I think this is much worse than that because CBS has come in and affected reviews. Now, I know it's not news and that seems to be one of the justifications here, but it is something that I could say with all honesty when I worked there, CBS never injected themselves into the content. Now they have. And apparently they seem to be silencing people because you don't see people from CNET talking about it. So I'm sure there's been a requirement that no one from CNET make any statements about it. That's typical PR stuff. And I think it's a big shame because CNET, I feel, has really turned it around in the past several years. I mean, they got rid of me for one thing. That was a positive. But they also, I think the news has just been killing it. I think Lindsay Turrentine has done great things with the reviews team. And this is a huge black mark, in my opinion, on CBS's management of CNET. And I would implore you not to hold this against CNET editors. But at the same time, I understand, and even myself, I'm a little suspicious now of this, and I still think that the CEA should take the best of awards away from CNET. John, do you have anything to add here?
You know, this is a really, again, we're talking about complicated issues today. This is really another complicated issue. As a member of an editorial staff, it is, to me, it's an outrage. It's exactly what we've all been saying, and it is a black mark. And it is, I can't imagine anyone over at CBS looking at this and not realizing that there could be a major stink coming up from this, especially at an event like CES, where we have the world of technology journalism all in one place at one time. Many of these people are running independent blogs that have no connection to any major corporate affiliate, and they're free to say whatever they want, and they've got a lot of followers. There's just no way this was ever going to turn out to be a good thing. So that puzzles me, but speaking as someone who works in a really big company, you know, there are times there are discussions that happen in a department that is literally hundreds of miles away, and those discussions may make perfect sense within the confines of the boardroom that they're going in. But when the outcome starts to unroll through the rest of the company, it can seem counterintuitive to some of the rest of us. So while I still think of it as an outrage, I can't just jump forward and say that this was, you know, an act of petty, vengeance against another company because of litigation. I honestly don't know enough to be able to answer that.
I think we're all missing something, maybe the big, big, big picture here, and that is the Hopper was really a finalist for Best of CES? I mean, seriously? Because if that is, that says a lot about CES right now. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. You're good. I'll tell you what. That or big TV.
Yeah, no, it's also something actually new, not something we saw last year that they promised was coming next year.
Yeah, John, I take your points. I don't see why CBS would do this otherwise. It just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And all of the unnamed sources say that this has to do with the court case, and that makes sense. I actually understand the CBS lawyers' position in this. What disappoints me is not that the lawyers were pushing for that. Of course they should. That they want to protect their case. It's that the decision was made in the favor of protecting the lawsuit versus in the favor of protecting editorial integrity. And they sacrificed editorial integrity for what I think is a possible benefit in the legal case. So it just
that's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go to something actually fun, the randomizer. Actually, this is complex and very disappointing as well. The White House has rejected a petition for the United States to build a Death Star.
I am shocked and shaken and all kinds of disappointed.
What's great is that they actually constructed a reasonable response to the petition. You know, the White House has that petition thing. If you get enough signatures, the White House has to respond. And they the name of the response from the White House is, this isn't the petition response you're looking for.
Nice.
They cited the $850 quadrillion cost as one reason why they wouldn't be able to do it. The administration also is not in support of blowing up planets. And they say that the Death Star has a fundamental flaw that can be exploited by a one-man starship.
Does anyone know how to say that amount of money? It's 850. Is it
quadrillion?
That's quadrillion?
I believe that is quadrillion, if I am correct.
Million, billion, trillion, quadrillion. Correct. Yes.
So they claim that they're not going to pursue building a Death Star. But I hear that there may be an announcement later on in the week about a new moon discovered. And I say, that's no moon. That's a space station.
People familiar with the matter say, that's no moon.
You want to know why we haven't gone back to the moon since the 70s? That's because we've converted it into a Death Star.
Yeah, on the other side, the dark side. You can't see it. All right, let's check in quickly with the calendar.
All right, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah. Disney is unveiling a new gaming initiative called Infinity, or at least they're scheduled to tomorrow, and also that Facebook press event happens tomorrow at 10 a.m. On to what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Just one email to talk about today. Nick in Gladstone, Queensland, Australia, said, hey, TNT crew, you guys missed the most important point of comparison between the Wii and Wii U sales figures. Nintendo, unlike Sony and Microsoft, had always sold their consoles at a profit until the Nintendo 3DS price drop in 2011. From that point on, Nintendo has taken a loss on both of their new hardware lines, the 3DS and the Wii U. So since the Wii has always been sold at a profit and the Wii U is sold at a loss, that makes the 460,000 Wii Us versus 475,000 Wiis just bad news all around. They're actually losing more money because they're selling more Wii Us. That's a funny way to look at it. Of course, it's a lost leader. That's the way PS3 and the Xbox 360 are.
It's even bigger than that because it is supposed to be the lost leader, and it's supposed to be about the attach rate. You make your money back on the licensing from the games. So if people aren't buying 4 or 5 games per Wii or Wii U, it's not worth it. You're not making back your investment.
All right, well, that's it for this episode of Tech News Today. Actually, I seriously would like to thank Ayaz Akhtar for writing a bunch of the news fuses today from his sick bed, as well as picking our email. Sarah Lane put together one of these discussion segments and the calendar for us today. So those guys are troopers, and I hope they get better quick. Huge thank you to you guys for joining. Brian Brushwood, what do you got going on you want to tell folks about?
I'll tell you what, if you want to sit around waiting with bated breath, stick around for 4 hours and we'll be back right here to talk on frame rate about all the latest ways to cut the cord, all the latest news on streaming video and I guess viral video as well. And the harrowing last minute finish of this year's NSFW summer or winter movie draft.
Maybe we should hire Greg Sandoval to join us.
Yes.
John Strickland, what's going on with you?
Well, got my Tech Stuff podcast. I've got a brand new co-host named Lauren Vogelbaum, and she is currently killing it on the podcast. So if you guys haven't listened in a while, definitely come over, check it out, because I'm really proud of it, and it's going to be an amazing year. We've got some Tech Stuff video projects coming down the pipe pretty soon. And of course, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm John Strickland.
Do
I make it complex?
JonStrickland. Land. And I presume we have a new This Week in Enterprise Tech coming up.
We have a brand new TWiET. We're going to be talking about ergonomics in the workplace, and it's actually quite exciting. We're going to be talking about sitting and standing. Follow us on Twitter. We've got PadreSJ. If you follow us, you'll be able to find out what we're doing every week and maybe even suggest a couple of episodes. And the big announcement is I went to CES and I didn't get sick for the first time in 17 years.
No, you just did it.
And I just did it. I just did it.
All right, that's it for us, folks. Submit stories for consideration at our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. You can also find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. Email us, tnt@twit.tv, or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We will be back tomorrow. Who will be here? Who knows?
We'll find out.
We'll see.